Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV
One. Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, drama in South Carolina as the jurors in the Michael Slager trial will resume deliberations today in South Carolina in a desperate attempt to reach a unanimous verdict as one juror is unable to convict the former cop of murder or manslaughter. Also, former NFL star Joe McKnight, he was shot and killed in Louisiana. Why did his killer walk free? We'll discuss what's next in that investigation. Also, victory perhaps short-lived for Native Americans and environmentalists protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. We'll have the latest on that as well. Plus, it's Fit Live Win Monday. And today, we're showing you how to winterize your workouts. And also, folks, Donald Trump picks Dr. Ben Carson to be his HUD secretary. We'll break it down as well. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. A jury will begin a fourth day of deliberations today in the murder trial of former North Charleston, South Carolina police officer Michael Slager, who was accused of killing Walter Scott. On Friday, the case was teetering towards a mistrial as the foreman, who was the only African-American on the 12-member jury, sent a note to Judge Clifton Newman saying they were, quote, hopelessly deadlocked due to a holdout juror. The judge read a letter from that juror to the courtroom.
I still cannot, without a reasonable doubt, convict the defendant. At the same time, my heart does not want to have to tell the Scott family that the man that killed their son, brother, and father is innocent.
Slager shot and killed the 50-year-old Scott, who was unarmed, in April 2015 when Scott fled on foot after being pulled over for a broken taillight. The cell phone video shows Scott being shot in the back. Slager testified in court last week about what he said was not captured before the video started.
Mr. Scott grabs the taser with his hand and starts yanking on it. And then he grabs it with his other hand and yanks on it with both hands. And then he rips it out of my hand.
Did he ever give you any indication of compliance or surrender?
No, not at all.
And what did you do next?
At that time, I pulled my firearm and I pulled the trigger.
Slager could be convicted of murder or a lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter. If convicted, he could spend 30 years to life in prison. Joining us via FaceTime from Charleston, South Carolina, is Pastor Thomas Dixon, a community activist and founder of the Coalition People United to Take Our Community. Also from Skype, from Binghamton, New Jersey, New York, is Jazz Shaw, the weekend editor, hotair.com. And so, Pastor, I want to start with you first. Again, this is, we saw the video there. We saw his testimony. Prosecutors were very, very clear in their cross-examination saying, you pull the guy over for a stoplight and he ends up dead.
Yes. Yes, very clear. That's that unfortunately that's been the norm across South Carolina nation. But this should never happen in America. Never a law enforcement officer be judge, jury, and executioner. They're called to serve and protect. And Walter Scott, in the case of Walter Scott, his not only his right to due process was denied, but his right to life was denied by officers. And anybody who watches that video can clearly see that this is an open and shut case, in my opinion, of murder.
Are you surprised that it was 11-1 to convict?
Not in South Carolina, unfortunately, because there are 11 white jurors in South Carolina and one African American. I guess I, in a way, I am surprised because it was 11-1 to convict. I'm sorry. Yes, that is sort of surprising.
Jazz Shaw, this has been a case that so many people have been paying attention to all across the country. North Charleston moved very quickly to charge Slager for murder, and they did not do like other places where they waited 6 months or a year. They said that it was cut and clear what took place.
Well, I think they made the right move, in my opinion. I think there's only one person in the wrong so far, and although you hate to try to read into people's hearts without speaking to them, and that's that one juror. There are many cases of police shootings where we don't have such clear-cut evidence, or things become jumbled in the reporting, and it does take a long time, frustratingly so for many people, I'm sure, to come to a resolution. This one, it seemed like they had it in the bag, you know, on the second day. I don't know why it even took this long, really.
And so now they go back. Now many folks are concerned that if they are able to convince this juror to change their vote, this somehow could open a significant appeal for Schlager's defense team.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to speak to that. Anytime you have a conviction on a serious charge like that, there's undoubtedly going to be an appeal. But it would be disappointing to me in the extreme, and it would be very bad, in my opinion, for police around the country as well as the citizens they interact with, if this somehow resulted in either a mistrial or a finding of no guilt and there being no accountability for it, because it's extremely rare in what I've studied that you do have police officers that go that far off the beam. But this seemed to be one case, and we're going to lose the confidence of communities if we have that sort of video sitting out there, and then the person accused of it just walks away.
Pastor, what about that? The confidence, as Jazz said, about the community. That's what we've always been hearing, that, again, folks say, look, charging and indicting is one thing, convicting is another.
Jazz just nailed it. There's no way we can continue to have these cases going to court and law enforcement officers who commit these heinous acts get off scot-free. They walk. And the community, and then we turn around, we ask the community to participate and to join in the process and aid law enforcement. But there's not an attitude of fellowship. There's not any kind of a bond developed. Every time that we see an officer who shoots an unarmed African-American citizen, they walk. And when it comes to North Charleston and their swift action when the video was released, we got to remember for 3 days they were developing a case to support Schlager. For 3 days, and had that video not surfaced, Schlager would still be on the job today. I have no doubt in my mind.
All right, then, Pastor, certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Jazz, thank you very much as well. Let's go to our panel. A. Scott Bolden, attorney and former chair of D.C. Democratic Party. Lauren Victoria Burke, political analyst and writer for NBC Black. Eugene Craig III, vice chair of the Maryland Republican Party. First of all, it was amazing how quickly people reacted on social media on Friday when this dropped, and people were fearful that this would be declared a mistrial. But the jury foreman came back and said, give us another shot. The judge allowed them to rest over the weekend, come back today. Scott, give us a sense of somebody who's been in the courtroom and you've had this happen. What's next?
Well, I've been on both sides of this as a prosecutor and criminal defense lawyer. The jury comes back. They go back into deliberation. If they come back hopelessly deadlocked, then it's the discretion of the judge to either send them back or to allow them to declare mistrial. Now, this is the perfect imperfection of our criminal justice system. It takes 12 jurors to convict. Super important. Having said that, though, I'm relieved that it's 11-1, because if it's 11-1 and there's a mistrial, the government is going to retry this case. That video is clear, and this juror, who we would call a self-juror, who somehow got by the prosecutor and the defense doing voir dire, clearly doesn't want to convict a police officer. Police officers, entertainers, and politicians are the hardest people to convict for the government, and in this case, they've got one holdout. That can be resolved by the retrial. Now, the biggest fear, lastly, is this, that they come back with a conviction of a compromise for manslaughter, which I think would be the wrong decision. It needs to be retried.
Lauren?
Politicians are hard to convict.
In Washington, they are.
I would say that because you just had the former CEO of DeKalb County, who had his conviction overturned by the Supreme Court ruling. So he's actually right.
Less than a week, Shaka Fatah is going to be sentenced to.
No, I understand
over 20
that.
Years.
But the DeKalb County CEO, who's
Brim Brown, has no legal defense.
But
when the government goes after people, they go after people who have no money, and that's usually politicians.
Brown, DeKalb County CEO, yeah, okay, who is black, okay, and his conviction overturned. Okay,
have Corinne Brown on the show again.
No, no, I'm just saying. I'm just giving an example of an African-American politician who just had his case overturned. So to Scott's point, he's right. It does happen.
By the way, Bullock just agreed with me. Let him agree with me.
Eugene, your thoughts on the South Carolina case?
You know, this is... You know, early in the year, I said, if all lives can't matter, so all lives matter equally. And, that juror, you can't look the Scott family in the face and say this guy's innocent. Then convict him. That tells you right there that you know he's guilty. But you're letting your bias, come into your decision on whether to convict or not. If we're going to really be a country that stands for no man's above the law, that we all are equal under the law, then we all need to be convicted equally under the law. Well, if I shot a police officer, that would have been an open shut case, especially with footage like that.
Well, here's the deal. You talk about the whole issue of whether or not somebody, open and shut. If you shoot someone, let's look at what happened in Louisiana with Joe McKnight. Of course, he was shot and killed, the former NFL running back, but the guy who shot and killed him is a free man. Police released 54-year-old Ronald Gasser Thursday night, just hours after gunning down McKnight in an alleged road rage incident in Tarrytown, Louisiana, just outside of New Orleans. According to the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office, Gasser and McKnight had a heated verbal exchange after one of the men cut the other off in traffic. Things came to a tragic head when Gasser drew his semi-automatic handgun, shooting McKnight multiple times. Gasser's release has sparked outrage throughout the New Orleans area and the nation. Despite the controversy surrounding McKnight's death, his family is shifting their focus elsewhere.
We're not commenting on that right at the moment. We just want to keep the positive. We want to keep the positive and keep moving forward and staying strong. That's it. My brother was a fun person. He was a family man. He loved a lot. He likes to play jokes. Everybody loved that. He was that type of person. You knew him. You know how he was. You know he was family.
Local police continue to stress Gasser isn't in the clear yet, and public outrage won't prevent them from investigating this case as they see fit.
And we're not going to reveal at this point in time any of the details of this investigation. Why? There are still witnesses that we are looking for. And I do not want to be accused of tainting this investigation or suggesting a story about this investigation to witnesses that we have not located and talked to. People can Monday morning quarterback what we've done. Mr. Gasser is not gone anywhere. He has been completely cooperative with us. The issue at the end of the day is that we will do a very thorough and deliberate investigation.
Joining me on Skype from New Orleans to discuss what's happening on the ground there is Judge Morris Reed, president of the NAACP's New Orleans chapter. Judge Reed, I'm still trying to, I heard the sheriff there. I cannot imagine someone gunning somebody down in a street there in New Orleans and the guy walks the same night.
This is incredible. It's incredulous. I'm aghast. Roland, just prior to an earlier case that occurred a couple of years ago in the same jurisdiction, in 2013, a black shooter, Mr. Ronald Batiste, in Jefferson Parish, the same district where the sheriff patrols every day, was arrested and charged for shooting a white male, 27 years old, who tried to enter his truck. He fired once, a 75-year-old grandfather. Guess what happened? They charged him with second-degree murder. They incarcerated him on a $500,000 bond. So the charges, the incident with Joe McKnight are certainly more aggravating because he was shot three times and may have been fired upon four times, and he was towards the rear of the man's car and made no attempt, that as it appears, to enter the car. Look, this is a checkpoint for Homeland Security. There's cameras abound. This man, Gasser, has a history of road rage attacks. He attacked a white gentleman, 51 years old, in 2006 at the same intersection. You know, this is crazy. But there might be some type of relationship with law enforcement with Gasser, and he indicated that at the scene of the shooting, that he has connection with law enforcement, because his occupation appears to be providing telephone service penal institutions. So, he may have political connections that the ordinary citizen doesn't.
Scott Bolden, real quick here, what do you make of this?
Well, It's the sheriff's discretion. Remember, Louisiana has a stand your ground law, which means that McKnight was outside, the shooter was inside his vehicle, and what the sheriff is struggling with and what needs more investigation is whether stand your ground allows him to walk or allows him even to be charged, because if he felt trapped, he had a gun, McKnight was out, and he felt he had no other course to but to shoot. That's what the sheriff is struggling with. I'm not saying that's right,
right,
but I'm saying that that's what it is. You gotta remember, stand your ground says I don't have to retreat, and I can use deadly force if I feel like I'm going to be bodily harm or be killed.
And Judge, real quick here, got about 30 seconds here. Several witnesses said they heard McKnight apologizing to Gasser for what took place.
That's correct. And in the earlier case with the Batiste case, and as I pointed out earlier, you know what the sheriff told Mr. Batiste, the criminal justice system told Mr. Batiste, a black grandfather, you should have taken some type of evasive action when this white boy was trying to break into your truck and attack you.
Got it, judges.
So what's good for the goose should be good for the gander.
Well, we'll surely be covering this, see what happens next. Judge, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Folks, got to go to a break right now. We come back, updates on the Dakota Access Pipeline. They have a major victory as a result of a decision by President Barack Obama. It is 15 after the hour. News 1 Now on TV 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number 2, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline are celebrating a major victory as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denies an easement for the pipeline. That means the current route for the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline will be denied. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and environmental activists have been demonstrating against the four-state oil pipeline for months. The project is over 85% constructed. They claim the pipeline construction could pollute nearby water sources and destroy the tribe's sacred sites. The Army Corps of Engineers' decision comes after months of prayer marches and clashes between protesters and law enforcement.
I'm just thankful that there were some leaders in the federal government who realized that something is not right, even though it's legal, and heard for the first time in history American Indian issues, heard our voices, and had the courage to take the initiative and make the right decision. And this is something that will go down in history, and I know that it's a blessing for all indigenous peoples.
Supporters, including President-elect Trump, say the pipeline will provide jobs and pump money into local economies. We'll see what happens next. A criminal investigation is now underway in the deadly Oakland warehouse fire that killed at least 33 people. Officials say the fire started during an electronic dance party on Friday night. The warehouse, allegedly converted into illegal lofts for artists, quickly went up in flames. According to the fire department, the building did not have a sprinkler system or smoke alarms. Witnesses say the warehouse soon became a death trap for people fighting to get out.
When the big like bellow of black smoke kind of came out of every window and it blew like out of the door, maybe like 10 feet, just this black smoke. And at that point, only a few more people crawled out.
Fire officials say about 40% of the building has been searched, and they expect the number of fatalities to rise. It could take weeks to identify victims. Investigators say range from the ages of 17 to 30. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments on whether or not race can be used to draw political boundaries in North Carolina. Progressive groups say North Carolina Republicans pushed racial preference rules to extremes in order to give the GOP an advantage in 10 of North Carolina's 13 U.S. House districts. But the state says the legislature is struggling to find a balance between taking race into account and not violating a vague rule when changing districts. The case is just one of several federal cases that has rewritten the rules for North Carolina elections over the past year. Analysts predict the case could help set the rules for how legislatures here and in other states draw up maps for years to come. Like I keep telling y'all, North Carolina is the Alabama of the 21st century. Big congrats to NBA star LeBron James. He's Sports Illustrated's Sports Person of the Year. The magazine awarded James a title for returning to his hometown Cleveland and leading them to a championship over the Golden State Warriors. Sports Illustrated is calling the Cavs win one of the greatest comebacks in sports history. Remember, they were down 3-1 to Golden State. Congratulations also in order for singer Mavis Staples. She's among the honorees of this year's Kennedy Center Honors Gala. Staples is joined by actor Al Pacino, the rock band The Eagles, and singer-songwriter James Taylor. This is President Obama's final Kennedy Center Honors Gala of his term. The group was honored last night. The event will air on CBS. All right, folks, when we come back on News One Now, Donald Trump has tapped Dr. Ben Carson to be his Secretary of HUD. We'll discuss that. Also, the new movie Jericho, it combines black history with comedy. We'll talk with the director and star of the independent film, who happened to be married. This is the News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Folks, Donald Trump has nominated Ben Carson to be his administration's housing secretary. Trump announced Carson's nomination in a statement, which says, in part, we have talked at length about my urban renewal agenda and our message of economic revival, very much including our inner cities. Ben shares my optimism about the future of our country and is part of ensuring that this is a presidency representing all Americans. He's a tough competitor and never gives up. Now, when Carson's name had been floated as a Trump cabinet secretary earlier, Carson's spokesman Armstrong Williams said that Carson had turned down a role in the administration. But this morning, I actually talked to Armstrong driving in, and he said this was the position that Carson wanted all along because he simply believes that he really could do more helping the nation when it comes to the issue of public housing. Let's go to our panel here, A. Scott Bolden, Lauren Victoria Burke, Eugene Craig III. Your thoughts, Dr. Ben Carson, neurosurgeon, that's where he got his fame. Your thoughts about him being the HUD secretary?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think about qualifications, and then I think he's not qualified for that. He's a brilliant surgeon. He's very committed to the country and has passion. Trump needs some diversity, and this is probably the only African-American of any significance that supported Trump, and I think that's where the appointment comes from. But I think we have to hope for the best with this administration and hope that Ben Carson not only listens but is really committed to putting dollars and policies in place to empower African-American communities.
And we know that, in fact, he's not, because he is not a housing expert. He knows nothing of this subject matter.
He does not know what he does
probably,
not know.
This indicates, of course, that Donald Trump doesn't care about this subject matter, because you put somebody who has no background in it whatsoever, you know, what does he know about federal housing
these
policy?
These are tough issues, too.
Yeah. What does he know about vouchers for Section 8? What does he know about FHFA? The good news is that Mel Watt doesn't have to leave, so Mel Watt will still be at FHFA watching this, because this makes no sense on any level. You know, obviously, Ben Carson is not a housing expert. I mean, you know, he's a smart guy, but that doesn't mean he knows housing.
I put it like this. If the guy can separate twins, I'm pretty sure he can figure out housing policy.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, furthermore, I mean, okay, the majority of the
I mean,
I think
I'm not a neurosurgeon, but I stayed at Holiday Inn Express last night.
Couple points here. First and foremost, Trump transition team is working on policies now to come in and deal with blight in the urban city, to come in and deal with urban renewal. Secondly, a lot of the work will be done.
Just now, they're working on that.
Well, they've been working on it since midsummer, you know, since the transition team came into place. But there are experts, there are folk like Ken Blackwell and David Byrd and others that are working on serious HUD policy to come and deal with urban renewal, to come in and deal with blight in our cities. Secondly, a lot of the work will be done at the undersecretary level. We know this. That's with every secretary, with every agency head. A lot of the work is done with the director level, the undersecretary level, the actual bureaucracy level. So I do think, you know, Ben Carson could actually come out to be an amazing Secretary of HUD.
As a figurehead.
Well, what would indicate that to you?
Right.
Certainly not his resume. He's never been in a federal job, never run federal bureaucracy in any manner, and suddenly he's going to be an expert on housing policy.
And when you
talk about a president whose family was sued on this issue of housing discrimination.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll believe it when I see it.
This isn't Fred Trump running HUD. This is Ben Carson.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay. I think.
Was his son protesting? Was his son protesting his father?
I think you look for conservative policies that I'm fearful will hurt urban America. And because of the lack of competence, or at least the lack of experience here, you don't know what you don't know. We're going to take a really close look at this, because
with several picks, by the way.
A lot of public housing is dealt with at the local and county level.
No, but here's the deal, though. We talk about public housing. I've covered housing throughout my entire career when I was a county government reporter, the Austin American-Statesman, City Hall reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. What we've seen, first of all, over the past 20 years, we've actually seen a shift, if you will, in traditional public housing. We saw when Jack Kent was at HUD. We saw when Henry Cisneros was at HUD as well, where you had dispersed housing, where you had folks shifting away from the large public complexes. I mean, look, the reality is this. The real question is, will this administration, and I believe the answer is no, will this administration deal with how developers have been pimping the process of saying we're going to build affordable housing when they get these huge tax breaks from city, counties, and states when it comes to building? And what we've seen, and I saw it personally in Chicago, we've seen this in other cities around the country, where developers get these deals, they do all this massive development downtown, near downtown, and what they deem to be affordable isn't affordable, and it ends up being housing for young white workers who then come in. And so then what happens is this here. Then, of course, the people who are displaced, they're pushed out of cities, pushed to suburbs, where it used to be where you had inner cities for folks who were low income. Now, all of a sudden, because whites left, now you have whites who are coming back into cities and moving those folks out. They don't have access to public transportation to those places, access to jobs. And so all of a sudden, it's happening in reverse. That's the question I want to know. Will the Trump administration stop a lot of those? Hold on, I want to start with Lauren, then Scott.
The thing is this. The majority of urban housing policy, especially when it comes to public housing, is done at the local, county, city, municipal level. Yes, the feds may provide some level of funding, but the overwhelming amount is done at the local level. And,
I think it's... I understand. I say it. I've covered it. But when you still have Washington providing billions and billions of dollars, the question I have on those policies, will it be reining in those developers who are, again, given major tax credits, and they're not providing affordable housing?
My argument is that those tax credits, a lot of those tax deals, people in Baltimore are dealing with it right now. A lot of those tax deals are done and cut at the local level. The feds have, I can't come in and tell the city government to come in how to distribute them.
The local level argument when they want to dodge the fact that the federal government is doling out billions of dollars. Right. What's going to end up happening with this as somebody who has worked in the federal government and covered Congress is that the real people who will be in power on this policy will be in Congress. Because what tends to happen when you get these policy novices in charge of a huge federal bureaucracy, billions of dollars and thousands of people, is they sort of just don't do anything, and Congress is the one that sort of functions the policy. And we're probably going to see that with a few things, because let's face it, Ben Carson doesn't know what he's doing. He'll get to travel around and smile and grin, on his junkets, but he's not going to make any real decisions because he doesn't know what he's doing.
Scott. the market forces work against poor and low-income African Americans, which get pushed out. That's the first thing. But secondly, HUD has a big stick, new market tax credits. Yeah. What they really need to do, and what we ought to be looking for, is whether jobs, job training, and entrepreneurship are tied to these tax credits, are tied to these developments, so that African Americans who are poor and disenfranchised have a fighting chance to compete for that low-income housing, or to just pull themselves up out of poverty with that big stick. That's what we ought to be looking for.
Well, I tell, the biggest issue for me is what has been happening in these cities. Well, these developers have frankly been pimping a process, getting millions and millions of dollars in breaks, and they promise affordable housing. But then all of a sudden, when it comes, you have very few housing units because they are going after, white, urbane homeowners. And then what they're doing is they're building all of these mixed-use developments. They're building these, all of a sudden, these downtown grocery stores and retail offices, and then you have places selling for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, and the very people who need affordable housing can't afford to live in those places.
That's market driven. That's anecdotal.
What data do you have to support it? Somebody who's actually been covering housing for 20 years. You're saying it's market driven? No, that's not what it is. No, Scott, this is not what's happening. What is happening is these cities across this country, what they want to do, they want to move these folks out. They're giving the developers, again, the developers are
promising, oh, we're going to build affordable housing for people who can afford it. No, they're not.
But then it's an enforcement issue then. Then
let's Hell, Scott, that's my point. Issue.
Then we agree on two things now. We agree
okay,
on
have,
two
you, have you been like sleep the last
no, I
six
haven't.
Minutes of this
but
segment?
You cannot continue to just call racism
no,
when you're
all,
talking about
on,
gentrification.
Scott, no, Scott, I never used the word racism.
You didn't use the word.
No, I didn't.
About
no, Scott.
Developers
no, no. First of all, Scott, I didn't. No,
out.
Scott.
Let's find a way to keep them in.
First, I didn't say white developers. Two, I didn't say pushing black people out. Developers are also pushing out poor white people, poor Hispanic people, poor black people. And so that's my point. And what I'm saying is we're seeing it in cities across the country where, again, developers are reaping millions and millions of dollars in tax credits all across this country, in cities across this country.
Got it.
And the people who need the housing, they're being forced to go out to suburban areas. And what happens is no transportation in many of those places, no jobs out there. So now they're saying, now also I can't afford to live out there. And what I'm saying is this here, the federal government is the one who should be enforcing these issues, and that's what's not happening. And so I don't give a damn about what's market-driven. I care about whether or not regular, ordinary people can have affordable housing. And the fact of the matter is, they're not able to have it, and that's
and
a problem.
And I started my comment out with look for HUD with the big stick to enforce the very issues that you want to address.
Well, first of all, when you already have, according to some stories, that Ben Carson doesn't believe in the Fair Housing Act, and that is when it comes to racial discrimination.
He knows what it is.
That might be a problem.
Right.
That might
he knows
be a
what
problem.
It is.
Scott believes in market forces.
Huh? Yeah. Well,
the Democrat Party
right,
believes in market forces.
It's quite obvious he does. Yeah, knock yourself out. Yeah, but you're right. You don't need to worry about affordable housing.
Man.
A bunch of folks out there have to worry about affordable housing. All right, y'all, when we come back, imagine two black men in the Deep South running for their lives on the same day the Civil Rights Act was signed. Well, that scene might sound terrifying. The new film Jericho will also make you laugh. The husband and wife team behind the movie joins us next. Plus, Fitliv Win breaks down how to you can transition for your summer to winter workout. All of that next, News One Now, TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now. With Roland Martin.
Jericho, a new movie about two black men who have been lifelong friends and are very excited by the signing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But on the same day as the legislation is being signed into law, they find themselves running for their lives from a racist family in the Deep South. The parts of the film are also funny. How in the world directors made that happen? Well, let's take a look.
First of all you men, keep your tongue in your mouth and keep your billfold on the table, because at the end of the night, I'm gonna get it all.
Did you see the paper this morning?
Hell yeah, Joe. I seen it. It's real.
This promotion's been a long time coming for me.
Well, come on, pick me up. You know, this is a fine automobile right here. Handcrafted from the finest materials in America. Never gave me a moment's trouble. Oh! I'm tired of this, John.
Tired of what?
This! Tired of being told I can't do this or that. Go here or there. All because I'm a Negro.
All right, folks, Jericho has been a hit on the film festival circuit, winning 9 total awards so far. Joining us via Skype from Dallas is the husband and wife team behind Jericho. Sakita Lewis is the movie's director, and Brandon Lewis is one of the film's writers as well as the star, playing multiple characters. All right, folks, how y'all doing?
Good. How are you this morning?
Right, so who came up with this idea?
It was my crazy idea to blend comedy with something so very serious, that being the civil rights movement in the Jim Crow era, deep south of Mississippi.
So you said, okay, hold up, let's see, Civil Rights Act, two black guys being chased. Yeah, we can go ahead and laugh at that one.
Right. There are some moments to laugh at, and they're sprinkled throughout the film as we try to deal with some very harsh moments, some of the harshest that you'll see. But this is something that we wanted to do in hopes of taking a new approach at it to bring people closer together, to bring people together for the better.
Yeah, the comedy allows you to really kind of sit and enjoy this film together, learn about our history together, and that the comedy allows you to kind of be able to take it all in at once.
Now, Sakita, you're an engineer. What yeah. all of a sudden happened when you're like, oh, what the heck, I'll direct a movie?
Originally an engineer, I'm then a marketer, and now a filmmaker. I think I've just always been really in love with storytelling and how to tell really unique stories, and so why not? You know, if you don't try, you can't achieve it.
So with this movie, how many days did you shoot it?
16 days that spanned it over Ferguson, Missouri, Mississippi, and Dallas, Texas.
And so the other piece of this here, so you shot over 16 days. And so have you released it? What are your plans in terms of your focus to put it in theaters, online, cable, on demand?
All of the above. That would be our goal. You know, we've been on the film festival circuit since April of this year, where we premiered it at the International Pan-African Festival in Cannes, France. And we've been kind of touring ever since then. But our goal now is to, you know, to get the film like in all of those mediums that you mentioned. We want to, you know, get it into the theaters and of course streaming and on networks, because it's a story that needs to be told and a story that really needs to be in every household.
Right. I mean, we see this movie as a perfect Netflix original, or maybe even a TV One original. This film is a film that takes a shockingly refreshing approach to something so very serious, and audiences have taken very well to it, and we feel that it's just what this country needs right now.
All right, then. Look, we certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much. Good luck with the film, and we'll see what happens next.
Thank you so much.
We're at JerichoTheMovie.com. We'd love to, you know, invite your audiences to go on Facebook and like our page. Help us with the momentum of the film.
All right, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Folks, when we come back, I'm going to pose a question to our panel. Should Colin Kaepernick be ripped for not voting? We'll discuss that next. Plus, also, is the cold weather upending your exercise routine? We've got tips to winterize your workout today in Fit, Live, Win. Next, News 1 Now on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News 1 Now.
All right, folks. So Colin Kaepernick has drawn lots of attention for his protests each and every single week when it comes to the national anthem. But in a recent interview, he talked about not voting during his election. He's been ripped by a lot of different people. Others say, look, that's his right. So I want to get our panel's thoughts on that. A. Scott Bolden, Law Victoria Burke, Eugene Craig. So the question is this here. Does Colin Kaepernick not voting somehow diminish or take away his protest?
Absolutely. It needs to be ripped about it. I think Stephen A. Smith said it best when he said, you cannot protest what's wrong with America and then not vote to change it. And people have died, people have protested, people have suffered for that symbol of freedom, which is the right to vote.
Yeah, I don't think there's any big problem with him not voting and waging this protest of police brutality, regarding police brutality. What we just saw in the Walter Scott case, you know, I don't know that you can make a direct line in some of these cases from voting to stopping somebody from getting killed in that way.
For elected officials who can make differences.
If you can make the argument that Eric Garner, and Michael Brown and these people would be alive because we voted, I don't know. I don't know if I can make that direct line.
I don't know if we can make that direct line. City council and mayors and federal officials.
The thing is this. Not given our history. I mean, I know what you're saying.
You're redefining history. You're going to keep that going, yet you're protesting the same thing.
So you think Eric Garner would be alive if everybody voted instead?
I don't know. I'm not a prognosticator.
And by the way, the prosecutor in the Eric Garner cases, I see him every day walking down the hall because Why? I mean, I don't think that you can make a direct line.
So you're advocating not voting?
I'm not advocating not voting. I'm saying him not voting doesn't delete his protest and make it less.
I think it does. No, it doesn't. It's inconsistent with his protest.
The thing is this.
He's not making it better.
Not making it worse.
The thing is this. Protesting.
So he's not making progress then.
He got attention on an issue nobody paid attention to.
The thing is this. Protesting will raise awareness, but at some point in time, you have to take real action in our civil society, and there's no higher action in affecting our civil society.
Hold on one second.
Then voting.
But here's what's interesting. First of all, one thing that he's done is he's held various events for young
folks.
For young folks when it comes to knowing your rights.
Mm-hmm.
He's also stepped up and is personally distributing the $1 million that he said that he was going to do so to various organizations.
Right.
And so this is not somebody who's just kneeling. I certainly believe in voting. I advocated for on this show. I do not believe that Colin Kaepernick not voting somehow makes his protest or what he is doing utterly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
I can look at two things at the same time and I can say, okay, you did this and you're doing this. I don't believe that not voting cancels what he is doing.
Well, he's one of the 5 million people that contributed to not voting.
No.
And why we've got that.
Actually, not true. First of all, 43% of America didn't vote. It wasn't 5%.
Too.
No, I understand that.
I agree with you. I do agree with you. It doesn't diminish the other work that he's done. But when your biggest weapon, when your nuclear weapon is your vote, is your ability to have a decision, have a voice, and choosing your leaders, choosing the policymakers, choosing the folks that are going to come and formulate policy, that will hold police accountable, come and formulate policy, they're going to deal with sentencing reform, they're going to formulate policy, actually going to deal with the issues that Colin Kaepernick is taking a knee for, I don't think you can unilaterally disarm yourself on not voting.
It completely undermines
it. When blacks protest extrajudicial murder, we've got to be perfect. Colin Kaepernick has to be perfect. He has to be perfect. Why aren't we focused on what he's protesting?
The only way you get policy to actually deal with the issue is by electing people that will push the policy.
Our country is full of examples of violence.
Could you imagine if the prosecutor that Marilyn Mosby defeated in the primary had been the prosecutor in Baltimore City? Do you think he would abort the case against Freddie Gray? Could you imagine if Don Donovan wasn't the state's attorney in Long Island when Eric Garner was killed?
There would have been another one there doing the same thing, and you know it.
The thing is this.
No, give me a break. You know, you're trying to act as if voting is going to fix some of these systemic 400-year problems that we have that the black communities have dealt
with. Politics is a game. Politics is a game of gradualism.
It does not negate what Colin Kaepernick is doing that he didn't vote.
Could you imagine?
This does not negate it. See, when black people protest, they got to be perfect. They got to be perfect.
Yeah,
they
do.
They got to be perfect. They got to be perfect.
If North Carolina white Republicans are voting to suppress things to suppress the vote,
right.
Colin Kaepernick, when he doesn't vote, is doing their bidding for those folks who are the same people who
whether
are oppressing
voted or not, that
black
would be
people.
Happening. Whether Colin Kaepernick voted or not, this, that would be
but
happening.
It'll be a strong step towards
you. You
got to do your part.
You know what pushes back against it? Organizing and getting people to the polls.
Absolutely.
Getting people to the polls.
So your party can suppress the vote?
No, I'm not listening.
I spoke out against, especially right here on the show, what happened in North Carolina, what happened in other jurisdictions. But that's not representative of
the Republican Party.
It's not representative of the Republican Party.
What Democrat is pushing and signing bills for voter suppression and voter ID?
I think there's some Bernie Sanders support, some black Republicans.
Doing that
probably by a better argument
for
any Republican.
He is a role model, which means when he says, I'm not voting, his impact on young voters and millennials goes even further. That's why Democrats,
so
one
rather,
part of why the Democrats are in the White
focus,
House right now.
You'd rather focus on his
I'd
voter registration
that he vote and
than,
honor
than
those
him
who
kneeling
died before
on,
him for that right to vote. Yes,
on,
I would rather
on,
that he
on
vote.
Police
but
honor
we know one thing. If
Colin Kaepernick chose to support tax credits for developers on affordable housing, Scott will be in his corner. But you know that.
But he's not doing that either.
You know that.
He's not doing that either.
All right. Colin Kaepernick does support the free market.
Yeah, right. There you go. There you go. Yeah.
$20 million a year.
What, you thought I forgot that? I thought so. Well, let me go to a break right now. We come back. We're going to talk about, again, getting you ready for your workouts this winter with Cootie Mack, News 1 Now on TV 1.
Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
That was folks at the University of Delaware on Friday. I was there speaking for their pre-Kwanzaa celebration. Certainly had a good time. If you want to see that, you can actually watch that video on my Facebook page. All right, folks, if the temperature drops, you might need to readjust your workout routine. Personal trainer Cootie Mack is here with his top tips to help you dress properly, winterize your workout, and stay healthy at holiday parties. What's up, man?
What's going on? How are you?
Oh, good seeing you, God. Good seeing you. So let's deal with this here. All right, so winter does change things for folks. They don't want to walk outside. They don't want to do much stuff. Plus, it's cold, so you just want to sit there, chill by the fireplace, and just don't do jack.
Right. And, you know, and the thing is, it's actually, in some instances, more than laziness, it's actually safe, because when it gets but so cold, you know, your blood vessels constrict, and that's how you start hearing about people dying and having heart attacks when they're shoveling snow, because they're doing all this hard work.
Right. I just don't shovel no damn snow. Yeah. I had that. So, I mean, thank you. I'll pass.
So it's a safety thing as well. It is a safety thing as well. So when it comes to the wintertime, one of the main things, if you are going to venture outside, be mindful of the temperature, be mindful of the clothes you wear. In wintertime, winter months, you have less sunlight. So you want to wear stuff that's kind of bright, you know, bright colored, white. If you don't feel like getting this flamboyant with it, wear white. Wear white, because you only have so many daytime hours.
Right.
And I mean, I've done it myself in my neighborhood, especially if you're in the suburbs, especially in the city, where you know you just don't see somebody coming. Mm-hmm. So the reflective gear is okay, but you really want to wear white. You want to wear clothing that's warm. Think about whatever temperature it is when you're working out, you want to dress 10 degrees warmer than that, because you're going to heat up in your clothes. And even though you don't want to be too hot, you can't overheat per se. So one thing you want to do is you want to keep skin tight type clothing on, something that's like right there, that's form fitting, and then wear that underneath the layer. So something will really keep you warm. And nowadays, the good thing is the fashion industry is kind of caught up with the fitness industry. So you can get clothes that you don't just run around looking like Rocky on the street in the 70s, which is, you know, bulky sweats on. You can actually, or wear those trash bags like everybody used to wear. You can actually look good while you're doing it. Cover your head. You can cover your ears. They got like I was talking about, you got sleek ear muffs, like stuff like this right here. You just wrap it around your ears. Boom.
Hands as well,
yes. A lot of gear now, they'll have a sleeve that goes all the way and covers your hands.
Right.
So that way you're good to go, and you can just kind of like, you still have access to your smartphones and track your workouts and things of that nature.
So what workouts are you also recommending indoors? Because again, people are used to, as they say, they don't have any equipment at home. They're used to walking and things like outside, but now you're indoors.
Right, so the main thing is, you can work out indoors. You don't necessarily have to have equipment. Every Friday on my Facebook page, BYBD Fitness and Nutrition, I post a new exercise that uses little to no equipment. And if it looks like it's super challenging, just scroll down. There's a whole bunch in there for all fitness levels. But exercises as simple as doing jumping jacks for 60 seconds, resting for 60 seconds, repeat that 4 times. You can run up and down your stairs. Spend the same amount of time that you would exercising outdoors, indoors. So don't cut it short just because you're indoors. But you can also shadow box. So let's say you have knee issues or lower body issues, you can shadow box, and that's really good cardio. That's that you can do for 2 minutes, rest for 2 minutes, and do that 4 times. You can jump rope. Jump rope is a very simple thing, cheap, and you can just jump rope. And people, it's something we did when we were kids, but it's something you can really do and really get a nice cardio workout in.
You know, I do Thai boxing 3 or 4 times a week, and sometimes it's outside.
Yeah.
And so we go real, real hard.
Really?
And when I get overweight,
really?
When I get overheated, what's the best thing to do? Because my trainer, we go right back in, even though we're layering with our workout, and we've got the boxing gloves and stuff.
What
do you do when you do get overheated? Because I sweat a lot when
water.
I'm outside.
Tax credits are bringing that heat down. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No problem.
In all seriousness.
Keep water handy. Mm-hmm. Keep water handy. And anytime you feel like you're just truly overwhelmed physically, whether you're in the gym or out of a gym, 3 minutes of rest, sitting still, generally will just kind of help you normalize.
Yep, yep. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Anything y'all got? Y'all ain't working out in the winter, so I don't know why I'm even looking down there. So, I mean, Lauren, do you ever work out?
Listen, I'm doing time boxing 4 days a week.
Every time we win, Lauren, like, I ain't got nothing to ask.
Y'all just all need some gloves.
Can you explain active rest? Because when I'm working out, my trainer always says active rest.
Active rest.
I'd rather just sit down and have water.
Yeah, and sometimes.
Why is that important?
Active rest will keep your heart rate up. So if you just walk around while you're catching your breath or sitting on like one of those sports balls, that's probably the best way. Sit on the sports ball and just bounce, and you literally keep your heart rate up while you're resting.
I'm gonna try it next time tomorrow.
Okay, you should. I did. Cootie Mac, where can folks get more information?
All right, so you can hit me at Instagram @CootieMac. You can hit me on Facebook BYBD Fitness and Nutrition. You can hit me online at BeYourBestDaily.com.
All right, folks. Tomorrow, I'll be broadcasting from Texas A&M University. They're having these Aggie United event being coached by Hill Harper. V. Bozeman will also be performing. Of course, white supremacist Richard Spencer, who I destroyed here on TV1, a former student invited him to speak on the campus. The university cannot stop him from speaking. They chose instead to have this Aggies United event at Kyle Field tomorrow night at 6 p.m. I will be one of the speakers, so look forward to that. So we'll be broadcasting from Texas A&M University tomorrow, as well as Wednesday, bringing you, of course, sights and sound from that event. You can also follow it online as well, and so look forward to that. Also, tomorrow on News One Now, as I said, I'll be broadcasting from there, so look forward to being in Aggieland, and I might even drop by Richard Spencer's event. y'all know he really wants to see me.
Yeah,
holla!
Why not?
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.